This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm here with the person I consider to be an old friend, Dr. Peter Ward. He's a climatologist at the University of Washington. He's also a biologist, and he teaches, he explores, he goes around the world exploring. One of his specialties is why things go extinct, and maybe that's something humans have to pay attention. Peter, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me again.
You're the author of many books. Under a Green Sky really turned my life around, frightened me a little bit, and I now understand you have a new book that I'd like to talk to you about in a few minutes, but tell us what's the title and what's it about.
My new book is dealing with what I think is the most significant and scary aspect of climate change, which is the fact that as we warm, which we are doing, ice melts, obviously. And the ice that's melting is in the Arctic and Antarctic regions. And it is that ice melting that causes sea level to rise. And it's rising sea level that poses the most important threat, I think, to human civilization. Not so much from the water coming in my office now and getting my feet all wet, but the sea level rise really affects us from what hurts us most, which is, to me at least, my stomach, feeding. Sea level rise is going to affect agriculture. Agriculture in a planet where we're at 6.6 billion, going up to 9 billion, we cannot afford to lose low-lying agricultural grounds. And that's what sea level rise can do.
Okay, well, I want to really dig into that in the second part of our interview. For right now, though, we've just had one heck of a summer. We had the Russian heat wave, and, well, in fact, the hottest July ever, according to NASA. And we had the Pakistan floods, as you know, and the Arctic ice is really low. Can you talk to us about some of those events and your take on them?
Well, any one particular year or any one particular summer can never be used as a justification for a trend, obviously. But nevertheless, if we look at the last 10 years, we have some of the hottest, I forget how many of the year, hottest years on record, we're starting to really look like a trend. I think that the Russian heat wave, as well as the Pakistan, the way the monsoon worked, are two of the scariest nudges, really, that should get our politicians pushed to really understand this is not going to go away. Now, we may be followed by two or three very cold winters or very, very cold summers, even in Russia or somewhere else, and people will be tempted to say, aha, see, it's over. But it's not. Last winter in the U.S., we had one of the snowiest winters ever, and people say, look, there's no global warming because it snowed and snowed and snowed. Why did it snow so much? Because there was way more water in the air that hit the cold, cold Canadian air coming down, and you've got more water in the air because elsewhere it has been warmer than before. We've got more water vapor because of the heating. That hits a cold front, of course, it's going to snow out, but it's all part of the same problem. The warming of the planet is causing extremes of weather. Our civilization is based on a norm, not extremes. Extremes are never good, and extremes are really never good when it comes to feeding the planet.
I think you bring out a really good point that it could be cold next winter, and that doesn't say anything. It's the long-term trend that's going. We had Senator Inhofe out there building a snow house for Al Gore just because it snowed in D.C. last winter. Come on. But the point is, these extreme events, it's been predicted they'll happen more often, and that seems to be what we're seeing. So when does the point come where we say, yes, this is climate change?
Well, that's a great question. I believe that generation by generation, as this keeps ramping up warmer and warmer and warmer, that conversation will be over. But in the meantime, we need action now. I've been completely disappointed by the Obama administration and what it has not done for climate change. Yes, it pushed through health care, but climate change should have been number one, because climate change will ultimately be, I think, a major factor in health care. When we start seeing on the global sense people without enough food, even if the U.S. and Canada can feed themselves, it's going to have an effect. The effect that happens is as our surpluses go away because of these extremes of weather. I mean, already because of the Russian heat wave, as we know, the wheat futures have been skyrocketing, and food riots began in northern Africa already. We saw this about 3 years ago with a downturn in the amount of corn going out because of the biofuel initiative. So we start putting more, just a bit more corn in a biofuel, and all of a sudden we've got food riots. We are really on a knife edge, and extremes of weather are the ones that will affect us most importantly, which is why I think we have to at least start the conversation in a serious tone in the U.S. we've got to do something about cap and trade. We really have to do something about global climate.
And yet that's off the menu for the Senate and for the House. They're just not going to do anything, apparently.
No, it's not going to happen, especially until this election is over. And if the Republicans again take over even the House of Representatives, what we can look forward to, at least in the United States, will be the next 2 years of investigations. No legislation, only investigation. And they've already said they're going to do that. You know, we'll take all these guys, put them in prison. This is not what the world needs right now. I just have this horrible sense, sinking sense, that 20, 50 years from now, there'll be this rogues gallery of the guilty sort of lined up on some wall. These were the people that let down the human race.
Well, the Arctic sea ice is again near a record low, but you say that doesn't really impact the rising seas idea. Can you straighten that out for us?
Sure. It's just some of the best pictures you can get. And again, because the northern hemisphere is a lot more approachable than the southern, Arctic sea ice disappears. People think, oh my gosh, this is really a big problem that's going to cause the seas to rise. Ice is melting. My gosh, the oceans are going up. But that ice is already floating on the ocean or sitting on the ocean. That's not the ice that affects us. It's ice on land that affects us. You cannot say that the loss of Arctic sea ice is unimportant. In fact, there is a huge secondary importance to that. We can come back to that in a second. It's Antarctica and Greenland that really, I think, are going to dictate the fate for human civilization over the long term. If we can keep the ice sheets in place, sea level will stay relatively constant. It is ice that's sitting up on land that melts. That every drop of that water causes a rise of sea level. Every single drop on some minuscule fraction, there's going to be some slight rise in sea level. The floating ice, nothing. The ice that sits on Antarctica and Greenland are the two really most important sources of sea level change. How can you not have global temperatures rising and not see an increase in the melting of those two bodies? And in fact, we are seeing those. Now, why the Arctic ice is so important, it's white. It reflects sunshine back into space. A white planet is cooler than a planet this dark. It's called albedo. As we melt away the Arctic sea ice, we get dark ocean replacing white sea ice. That ocean warms. It warms the whole planet to some minuscule, again, but some real fraction. The more Arctic sea ice melts, the warmer the planet gets, and there's a feedback here.
This is Radio EcoShock, and we're here with Dr. Peter Ward from the University of Washington. We're talking about his new book, The Flooded Earth, and just the general events of climate around the world. Peter, the new book seems a bit of a change for you. I know that you've been an expert diver. You've looked under the sea. You've poked around on land, working away at different ridges to see what the deep past can tell us. But now you're dealing with the cryosphere, the ice world. Why did you make that change?
Well, a couple of reasons. My deep past work has always been really looking at deep time. But over the last 3 years, that deep time has sent me down to Antarctica. And unless you're really, truly blind, you can't sit in Antarctica and watch it melting away as all that water makes its way from the land frozen to the ocean wet and not really understand that there's major changes taking place. I was able to see down in one of the Antarctic bases photographs of 50 years ago where the glaciers were around this particular base on the Antarctic Peninsula, and every one of them has receded, as we know, is taking place elsewhere in the planet. But secondly, there's something that deep time gives you the perspective of. Our problem, and we began this interview saying 1 year does not make a trend. But with deep time, you have all the years you ever want. We can go back 500 million years and look at the rock record for the last 500 million years. We have really good indicators of what the climate was like in deep time. Was it warm? Was it cold? Okay. In the warm climate times, how much ice was there on the planet? Well, zero to none. And what was the carbon dioxide levels during warm times versus cold times? So deep times lets us understand there's not a relationship between the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the temperature of the planet. We can get rid of that one because we have lots of people say, oh no, it's solar cycles and this and that. No, we really can see this one-to-one correspondence. Carbon dioxide goes up, global temperatures go up. We can go back 55 million years ago. Carbon dioxide was about 1,000 parts per million. Now it's 300 and almost 390. But back then, 1,000 parts per million, Canada was a lush tropical jungle all the way up to the Arctic Circle because we have crocodiles and alligators in the far northern reaches of Canada 55 million years ago. high CO2. Well, let's go back, way back. Let's go back to the Permian. Carbon dioxide dropped way below levels to what it was now. We had a 40 to 50 million year long glaciation. Down went CO2, up went the ice. And it just drives me crazy when we have senators in Oklahoma who discount this so simple relationship that deep time tells us. So certainly it was that deep time sense of things that got me into thinking about sea level change. We see it all the time in the rock record. You can watch on a sedimentary outcrop. You walk, as you go higher or lower, you can see that the sea level has gone up or gone down. Why not bring that to the modern day? So that was the impetus of this particular book.
And the sea level is so fundamental to our way of thinking. We think of it as a fairly fixed thing. All our docks are at a certain level. Our maps show so many feet above sea level. We're going to have to rewrite the geography of the world if this happens.
Well, little bit by little bit we will, but the greater worry right now is going to be rewriting the economic history of the world. We have just seen in the U.S. over these past 3 or 4 years this enormous depression, really. They call it a recession that was based on bankers being greedy. And one segment of the economy, housing, drove us into what is essentially a global slowdown. Well, what happens when we have to spend enormous quantities of money to change infrastructure? Not just one country, but every country. And let's look at something as simple as the height of a wharf or a pier. Sea level goes up, and global commerce deals mainly from country to country. Railroads, and many of these are right at sea level. Highways, many right at sea level, and shipping. And the ports themselves are predicated on sea level is not going to change. Well, some places where I live, there's what we call mesotidal. There's pretty high sea level changes just every day from the tides, 3 meters perhaps. But some places have no sea level change through tides every day. Well, look, global sea level is going to mean that every place is going to rise. If you have built a pier for a specific sea level, and that sea level changes by a meter or 2 meters, in many cases, that pier is not going to work anymore. You're going to have to rebuild that thing. Last year, CNN suggested, or at least thought, that by going through a series of economic models, they came up with several $1 trillion just to change pier height if it goes up as little as a half a meter around the world. Trillions of dollars. We've got so much infrastructure based on this sense that sea level will never change.
And I'm trying to imagine the possibility of drowned cities, and I think of the city of Alexandria, which now you can see museum tours of what they've brought up of the temples and the statues from under the Mediterranean Sea. Now, I know that was caused by subsidence, the sinking of the coastline, and it was caused by tsunamis from the earthquakes that happened over the 2,300 years since Alexander the Great founded that city. But 2,300 years from now, are you predicting we'll be, or someone may be, finding the remains of New York City or other great cities of the world?
Well, it really depends on if there is a critical tipping point or not. And once again, the temperatures of planets, we're doing a vast experiment, and we do not know what the answer is. I mean, it may very well be that that ice is pretty impervious, that it will take thousands of years for the ice to melt sufficiently to cause the flooding of cities. I mean, if it does melt, it's going to go up 80 meters, and then you could say, kiss goodbye all the coastal cities. But maybe it's 80 meters over thousands of years. But if we go back to the time of the highest sea level rise, the last glaciation, there was a lot more ice, and that ice melted from these vast ice ages that we've just come out of. We saw 5 meters per century, 15 feet in 100 years. That was enough to completely flood out a lot of coastal cities. And one of the most poignant, I think, was in the Black Sea. Divers have found a whole series of villages, and off Israel as well now, another series of villages that seem to have been flooded out by this really rapid rise, probably about 7,000 to 8,000 years ago, the most rapid of the rise of sea levels. 15 feet in a century is just, imagine Vancouver or Halifax or any of these cities that in 100 years you've got 5 meters sea level change. I mean, you're talking about wholesale calamity from an infrastructure point of view.
And that's happening at a time when many of us believe that we've reached peak oil, that our fossil fuel resources are going to be used up, and we're barely coping, as you say, right now economically. It feels like a depression to me also. So where are we going to come up with the resources to make these grand plans for adaptation, I wonder?
Well, I don't think there will be, in the sense that I think cities will just keep migrating upward and inward. The sad part will be the great fight over the great art treasures. Remember when we had these dams along the Nile, and there were enormous Egyptian art treasures that were going to be flooded. And the same in China. There was a whole series of archaeological areas that were to be flooded. Pretty soon, you just have to give up on some of this most beautiful of all of human architecture. You're just going to say, look, you know, it becomes triage. The city can be saved. The city can't. Dealing with economics, we can already look at the Dutch. The Dutch right now are spending vast sums of money on not just dikes. I mean, dikes is the simplistic way to look at it. It's far more complicated than that now. You put out sand dunes of great size. You have a whole series of river barriers, because it's not just the ocean going up. It's also the interaction of oceans and rivers where they meet them. This is a huge, important area for flooding as well. But when we start spending so much money on infrastructure to save a city, there's going to become a point where sooner or later you say, all right, you know, no more good money after bad. We just can't afford it. We can't afford it. A goodbye city. And I think Miami in North America is Galveston. That one's going to certainly be gone. Even with minor sea level change, those areas just cannot support any rise of sea level at all.
And in your book, The Flooded Earth, Peter Ward, you talk about the San Francisco and the Sacramento Valley areas. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, we know that at least in the United States, the greatest single agricultural region for productivity is the Great Valleys of California, the San Joaquin Valley to the south of Sacramento and the Sacramento Valley to the north. These are enormous, extremely rich, richly productive agricultural regions. I don't know the percentage, but a gigantic amount of North America's vegetables come out of this San Joaquin Valley and then further south into some of the troughs, the Imperial Valley, fruit, vegetables. We also have grasslands, enormous amount of livestock. These areas are vastly threatened not by the rise of the sea, but by the rise of salinity in the soil. Rising sea level is one problem, but when you have an ocean going up, it also goes laterally. As we know, if you have dry soil and just put some water on it, it diffuses through. Well, it actually diffuses through sideways very, very easily. And anytime you have salt water hitting agricultural soil, that diffusion sideways is our greatest problem. This is the greatest threat affecting Bangladesh, in fact. It's not so much that sea level rise is going to cover up a lot of their property, which it will. It is that the areas that the sea doesn't yet touch will still be ruined for agriculture. Bangladesh is a place where agriculture feeds its populace right now, but barely. But as their numbers rise, which they will in the next 50 years, and as sea level rises in the next 50 years, more and more salt is going into areas they cannot afford to lose. So this is, as I say, the single greatest threat. It is human starvation based on salinization of low-lying crop areas.
What is the range of sea level rise expected in this century by various scientific authorities?
Well, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, this is the multi-scientist organization that every country has put people in. They've suggested in their last assessment that we might see, oh, at most 59 centimeters, but they're thinking probably about 30 to 40 to 50 centimeters, somewhere in there, a half meter as the maximum problem by 2100. Now, this was put together in 2007 by a committee. And we all have seen committees at work, but not just that, it's put together by a committee of scientists, none of whom wanted to be labeled as an extremist. And so they went conservative. No one who really has been modeling and studying sea level rise, even at that time, people were screaming, that's just ludicrous to be so low. And we hope it stays so low, 44 centimeters or 39 centimeters. That sounds great. But now the sense is that if we have only 1 meter by 2100, that's great. But unfortunately, even 1 meter is increasingly looking like something that's very conservative. There's a man named Stefan Rahmstorf in Germany who does some of the best modeling. Now, once again, we don't have time machines. We can't tell you what it's going to be. So the only way you can do it is use mathematical models. But the model that Stefan has suggested is that if we have about a meter and a half by 2100, that's probably about right. Not 2 meters, not 1 meter, someplace in between, maybe 1.25 meters. So you're looking at 4 or 5 feet, according to most of the specialists, by 2100. So this is really difficult, very difficult for the agricultural sectors, very, very difficult for infrastructure to have to deal, even with 4 to 5 feet, meter and a half. That's a really tough number for society to deal with.
Well, my grandchild's 5 months old, so I expect it's possible he may see those levels of new seas, and it's going to be a startling time for him to go through. You know, Dr. James Lovelock and other scientists have suggested that without ice caps, the wind and the ocean currents could stall and become very pacified, and that could have big changes for the world's climate. Can you talk about that?
Sure. We've known from deep time again that when we have times of no ice, that's simply because it's very, very hot. The way the world works, when global warming happens, it does not happen at the same temperature range all over the planet. The ice areas, the areas that now have ice, in fact, heat up a whole lot more. We're seeing that now. We're seeing that the Arctic and the Antarctic are warming much faster than the equator. The equator is already so hot, it can't get a whole lot hotter. But the poles can certainly get a lot hotter. And what causes ocean circulation and wind in the first place? It is simply temperature differences. Whenever we get wind, it's because there's someplace hotter and someplace warmer around us, and the air is trying to move from one place to the other. Well, it's the same for ocean currents. The problem being is that once ocean currents slow or stop, oxygen availability to the deep ocean slows and stops. You start losing oxygen. So that's where you can really have some major problems.
And you alluded to something earlier, which I've heard from Dr. James Hansen, which is that once this process begins, there could be a tipping point beyond which, you know, reducing our carbon emissions and such may not have any effect, that it seems in the Earth's past, once the slide of ice goes off Greenland and Antarctica, it just keeps going under its own power. Did I get that right?
Oh, that's totally correct. Again, this is the scariest aspect, is that there is this sense of a tipping point. No one quite knows what the level of carbon dioxide that it would be, but we do know, again, that if we go into deep time, there's been little or no ice at all at 1,000 parts per million. Now, getting to 1,000 parts per million means burning up a whole lot of oil and coal, and it's almost a case where you think, gee, maybe we'll run out of both before we hit 1,000 or before we have 1,000 long enough to melt everything. Maybe we'll hit 1,000 and it'll dip back down. The fact is, there's a great amount of coal on this planet. The greatest misnomer to me of all is this mantra, clean coal, clean coal. Well, there's no such thing. Burning coal as the cheapest form of energy, and once oil is gone, as you well know, it will be the cheapest form of energy. Or the oil shales going on in Canada and Alberta right now with those oil shales, that will be or might be or soon could be one of the greatest single point sources of emissions on planet Earth. Is the formation of oil from oil shales. This is a really energy-intensive, emissions-intensive production.
Well, as we start to wrap up our conversation, which I'm really enjoying, incidentally, what other scientific research are you most excited about or worried about? What's got your interest?
Well, the hope is the reason we went to Antarctica in the first place is to hopefully get a sense of, is it possible that perhaps our models are wrong? Maybe it's just possible that 1,000 parts per million will still let us have at least some ice sheets. And so we're looking at Cretaceous-age rocks, these rocks from 65 to 125 million years old, to try to see how rapidly did sea level go up and down and up and down. Maybe there was ice sheet information to be had. Maybe we could still keep some of the ice at least at 1,000 parts per million. And if so, it really tells us that maybe we're going to have a little bit more time to deal with emissions. My worry is that it's not, but this is kind of the all-consuming thing to figure out right now. How high can CO2 be and allow you to still have ice? In other words, how long can we still keep Antarctica and Greenland at 1,000 parts per million?
Can you recommend a website for people who want to find out more?
I think that really the best climate source on the planet is called realclimate.org. And this is a consortium of climate people from many different countries, but They're not rabid crazies, but they're not conservative crazies. This is really middle of the road. It's at realclimate.org, and this is where I get most of my climate information. I have been in touch. These people are really great.
Right. I think Gavit Schmidt is one of the good writers there, and I check it out on a regular basis. Our guest has been Peter Ward. He's a paleoclimatologist and biologist at the University of Washington. He's got a new book out called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps.
That's it.
Yeah. And I find Peter's books are really exciting to read. They're page turners. They're kind of like detective novels, or maybe they're horror books because they're kind of scary, but they're definitely nonfiction. They are fact-based. And you want to get some good science, you go to Peter Ward. Radio EcoShock, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.